Okay. Just some corrections to that introduction.
My apologies.
I did not write Catherine. But the NACDL Forfeiture Task Force was instrumental in helping produce the CAFRA reform bill and getting it before Henry Hyde, who was the Illinois representative at the time. Remember Henry Hyde, a long gray hair, silver haired, really fascinating man from Illinois. And there's a long story about how CAFRA got enacted. It was a real battle between the reform movement with Henry Hyde and the DEA agents who got Orrin Hatch in Utah to present their asset, civil asset forfeiture reform bill, which of course was the most draconian bill you can imagine. You know, if they seize it, they forfeit it. You know, that's about what their bill was. So there was this big battle going on between Orrin Hatch's bill in the Senate and our reform bill that we were helping Henry Hyde introduce in the House of Representatives. And anyhow, we eventually prevailed. I think Clinton did some deal with Orrin Hatch where his secretary got appointed to the district court, and Orrin Hatch let this other judge get appointed to the Ninth Circuit. So he dumped the DEA, and we had a smooth path with Henry Hyde. And actually, there was actually both political parties in Congress at the time of this reform bill were really supportive of it. And it passed, and President Clinton signed it in 2000, and it's been somewhat smooth sailing since then, although there are some interpretations of some of the aspects of that bill and some of the rules that relate to it that have caused a lot of litigation, so we say, some of which Brenda Grantland touched on yesterday. Anyhow, let me see. This is my first PowerPoint presentation in my life. Thankfully, my son at UC Irvine helped me create it. I'm sure he threw some kickers in there. Let's see. Never give up, never surrender. Please tell me everybody has seen Galaxy Quest, the big spoof on Star Trek, you know, with Tim Allen, Sigourney Weaver, and Alan Rickman in that. So that's my whole theme, never give up, never surrender, anatomy of a forfeiture case, and how to really get paid. And this case really is about two issues. Let me see if I click this right. There we go. This is our movie. U.S. versus $85,668 in U.S. currency, featuring Trooper Chamberlain Neff and his drug dog tank. And there they are sitting on the back of his car using my client's $85,668 as a promotional device for his department. So we're going to get that money back, okay? Let's see how we do it. The interesting guy, Chamberlain Neff. This guy is the most aggressive self-promoter you ever want to run around. He's run across. He's a trooper in Utah. He is one of these troopers that we have come to know that aggressively pursue what we call interdiction. And there's all kinds of interdictions that can take place. There's highway interdictions, and this case will be a highway interdiction case, but there's other interdictions. There's bus stop interdictions, there's airport interdictions, there's interdictions in any kind of commercial travel that you can imagine. The government has got a program to learn how to stop people and question people and try to develop what they call reasonable suspicion. Trains, buses, airports, you name it. Now, what causes them to want to do these interdictions, or what cues them to do these interdictions, is interesting. There, of course, is this program called equitable sharing, where when the local law enforcement agencies, such as Chamberlain Neff, the trooper for the Utah Highway Patrol, seizes the property, gets adopted by the federal government, and the federal government sends a bunch of that money back to the particular police agency itself, and they get to use all that money to buy stuff that they hang on their belt, buy tanks, buy new cars, buy radar, they can buy night goggles, they buy whatever they want, and there's been some media attention about how these law enforcement agencies are getting armed where they look like military people. And that's where they get the money to do all that. They get it from all these forfeitures. And it's now I believe it's about a $10 billion industry a year. And so with this equitable sharing program, They give it to the federal government, the federal agencies adopt it, the DEA usually on these interdiction programs, and then when they get a forfeiture, that money comes back to the agency. But there's another sharing program, and it's called sort of a Department of Justice Rewards Program. And it's a secure little program, and it's in the rules for the Department of Justice. And anybody who gives information that can lead to a forfeiture, a seizure and a forfeiture, gets a reward. It's a reward program. And who becomes the people that get these rewards? It's every single ticket agency that you, ticket agent that you will ever encounter. A ticket agent for a train, a ticket agent for an airplane, and a ticket agent for a bus, and for any bus ride. And the federal government sends out these notices to all these ticket agents and tells them what to look for. And they tell them, look for this, and this looks suspicious, and if you drop a dime on anything that's suspicious in terms of somebody buying a ticket, you drop that dime on them, and if we get a forfeiture, we will reward you. And they give a reward from 5% to 10% of any amount that's forfeited. So you get a ticket agent. This was not a ticketing, this was a highway interdiction, it's different. But if you had a forfeiture of $85,000, you've got a ticket agent, if it came off of a train or a plane or a bus, who's getting maybe $8,000 as a reward for just dropping a dime on somebody who did something suspicious and buying a ticket. You know, and if I would suspect that if any of you walked in to the airport in Denver and you pulled out $1,000 in cash and you said, I want to buy a one-way ticket to any city in this country and I want the next plane and I want first class, that you will be met by a group of people that are not your relatives when you land.
You will.
And a 99% chance that they are going to search your luggage, no matter what you say or what you do. And when Trooper Neff stopped my guy, believe me, there was no way when a trooper stops a car based on their little aspect of reasonable suspicion, there's no way that he is not going to search the car. I don't care who you are, what you say. Maybe if you're a law enforcement officer or a judge, you won't get your car searched, but that's not a certitude. Okay, so anyhow, Trooper Neff stops my guy. He searches his car ultimately, and we'll see how that transpires. And there's a case that starts. And in that case, we do a whole lot of maneuvering with the U.S. attorney in Salt Lake City, Cy Castle, who actually is a very nice guy. And in that maneuvering, there's all these pretrial things that you have to do. And mostly you get a whole bunch of discovery. You get all the discovery you can possibly get. And these troopers go through all these programs. And if I show you a document that we obtained in discovery from Trooper Neff, you can see that this guy is a go-getter. So I'll stand over here and everybody can see on their screen. This guy's been a trooper for less than 3 years. Desert Snow Phase 5, Advanced Interdiction Course, Kennel Street Dog Seminar, Advanced Commercial Vehicle Interdiction, Desert Snow Phase 7, UPOA K-9 Legal Update, DPS Leadership Essentials, Crash Investigation, Desert Snow Phase, I don't even know what that is. It's Phase I-3? I have no idea what that is. And all this stuff where they go through all these programs. So we get this in discovery. Who is Chamberlain Neff? And he's got this little, it looks like a curriculum vitae that he's got promoting all of his stuff. And here's, look what he seized in cash. You see up here? $2,054,006. He's got the $6 in there in U.S. currency. This guy's been a trooper for less than 3 years, and he's already got $2 million that he seized in currency. And when you look at some of these programs that he went to, this is just a fascinating case. You look at some of these programs, and here's his Desert Snow stuff. You got to get this stuff in discovery because it's really exciting. And you look at some of these things here. I'm going to go to the other side now. Equal. Okay, look at some of this stuff. I just put all this stuff up, and you can see some of the stuff that they look at, and it's silly stuff. You know, and this is all the stuff, conversational questionnaires, and where are you going, where are you coming from, stuff like that. But it gets into some deeper stuff. The record checks, that's okay, you can do the record checks. You know, but then it goes to this thing called indicators. Oops, I screwed up. Okay, indicators. See this thing, indicators here? look at these indicators. They're like wild stuff. Separate occupants, I have no idea what that means. People coming from source or distribution city, and I'll show you later a footnote we put in our briefs when they talk about source or distribution city. Every single city in this country is a source or distribution city. You're doomed. You're doomed if you live in the United States, okay? Okay. Heavy smell of deodorizers, we all know that, and perfumes and something to mask odors. Unreasonable reason for the trip, that may be okay. You get to some of this stuff, it's just crazy stuff. Visible air fresheners, cell phones, pagers, road atlas, maps. tools lying in the open, that sounds really suspicious. Fresh Bondo paint, see or smell, positive epic response, that's okay. Disclaimer, is that all? Question mark for his stuff? No, it's not all. You know, how about disclaimers? Stuff like religious articles, Bibles, to put the officer at ease. I gotta tell my clients about this stuff. Law enforcement officer stickers, gotta put those on your car. Baby on board, relation to law enforcement or other badge carrier stuff. And it goes on and on and on, all this stuff. It's just crazy stuff. I don't know about that one. Okay, here, if you're Mexican, if you're wearing nice cowboy clothes, good English, and you're the owner of the vehicle, you know, that's, you're dead if you're Mexican. Let me tell you. And look at all these other indicators. They're crazy stuff. Passenger wakes up and sprays cologne, eats fruit, pulls over and stops voluntarily. What the shit? If you don't, you're dead. Hide behind the doorpost. I have no idea what that means. Yeah. No eye contact. Female or male driver. So I don't know what the unsuspicious driver is. Okay. Take ramp to nowhere. I thought that was kind of cute. This one work? Does this work okay?
Oh, it's sounding not so great.
All right, pretty good. Bad weather? No idea. Okay. Professional meals. Dress nice. Some of this stuff just, I mean, this isn't like really critical to what I'm talking about, but I just, females, 50 to 55, okay? You're the suspicious one. Rather go to jail. I guess when you're over the hill or when you get that age, you're okay going to jail. By herself or with other females. Nice dress. Flower shop. Dress shop. Who knows? I mean, they're all over the place. Sunflower seeds, I don't know, it helps them get from point A to point B. Is there some sort of buzz you get from sunflower seeds? Am I missing something? Okay. Multiple addresses, Christmas package, reason, blah, 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 blah. This is Desert Storm stuff, though. You know, I don't even want to go over some of this stuff. Terrorists, forget about that. There's all these indicators. You know, and all the stuff you've got to be aware of. So here's my client's car, and I want you to note something. This picture, of course, is taken by Chamberlain Neff, Trooper Neff. And my client's not taking that picture. And I think you can see over here on the right side, they finished a search, and that's probably my client's money sitting on the ground right there. All these officers are contemplating it. But look at this license plate, okay? See, there's a license plate, and in between in the center, there's what? There's a registration thing. And the registration thing says 2009, okay? The stop is 2008. Critical. Critical point, okay? Here's what they get from his glove compartment that he brings back to the patrol car. This is the vehicle ownership. So he's got the vehicle, it's got the license plate number, it's got the fact that the tabs were given for the registration here, it's got that it's owned by my client, it's got that it's a 2002 car, and this is a 2008 stop. So it's a 6-7-year-old car. Everything, this registration is as clean as you can get, issued by the state of Missouri. Okay, so he got registration, he brings it back, and he's got registration tags on the car. So, we go to court. We go to the U.S. District Court in Salt Lake City. There it is, a classic old building, little trolley car running next to it. And we get assigned to Judge Sam. No. That's my son. That's not Judge Sam. So Judge, I've met before, though, I think. Jerry, have you seen this guy?
Absolutely.
Here's Judge Sam.
Okay.
Baby Sam. Judge Sam is
probably...
I got to tell you, when you hear the rest of the story, Judge Sam is one of the nicest judges you ever want to meet in your life. He's one of these judges that I really like because I do a lot of litigation out of my territory. All right, I'm all over the country. And the reason I do is because a lot of lawyers call me because the forfeiture law is so twisted and convoluted and rarefied. It involves civil procedures and criminal procedures and a bunch of other weird things such as what Brenda mentioned yesterday, that a lot of criminal defense lawyers want to say, look, just take the forfeiture case, do it. You know, I don't want to get into forfeiture law. It's like just a whole other body of law. So I'm all over the country. And what I've learned, and what I believe, and what I practice, and the attorneys that I work with practice, is when we go to another jurisdiction, we want to get to know that judge. These judges are bored. They get people appearing before them. They don't know who they are. They show up. They're in their suits. They do their argument. They disappear. You've got to get to know the judge, and it's really critical. And we do it. We do it in a lot of different jurisdictions. You got to be careful. Some judges don't want you to know them, and you can figure that out. But when I go to a jurisdiction, the first thing I do is I show up about a half an hour early or an hour early. I grab the prosecuting attorney. I say, let's go talk to the judge in chambers and let's introduce ourselves. You know, let's go talk to the judge. And there's many, many judges that let you do that. Some judges won't, and their clerk will say, no, he doesn't want to do that. He'll just see you on the bench. That's fine. But many judges are interested. They want to know, who are you? Where are you from? What are you doing? Why are you here? That kind of stuff. And you gain some really incredible benefit from doing that. You put a personality on the face, and it has an effect. And I'll tell you how this worked out in this particular case. So Judge Sam is of Romanian descent, and he is one of those kind of judges that when we finish a hearing, he gets off the bench and he comes over and he talks to us. He talks to the prosecutor, he talks to the defense attorney. And I had some interesting dialogue with him. He did some international work with The Hague. He does a lot of special stuff for the Romanian government in terms of the legal system. I've done some work overseas in Southeast Asia, some legal stuff, and we had some common things to talk about. So anyhow, we get Judge Sam, okay? And we're in litigation. And I just want to give you an idea of the name of the case. Here it is. Rick Van Wagner, who's up on the top there with me, is my local counsel. He's with the oldest law firm in Utah and largest law firm in Utah, Snow Christian Martineau. Great guy, Richard. He argued the polygamy case before the Utah Supreme Court. Just a really good guy, and so I enjoyed having him as local counsel. We worked together on another case in Utah some years before that. And it's a U.S. versus $85,668, is exactly what Trooper Neff said that he sees from my client. And this is just to show you that the caption of the case. So we get into this litigation, and we do a lot of motions, and ultimately we end up doing a motion to suppress. But before you do the motion to suppress, you get a lot of discovery. You have a lot of battles with the U.S. attorney. They try to dump you out of the case on this concept called standing, which is something I can talk about for hours in another forum. They try to dish you. They try to show that you. They try to make you prove up your case before you even get into the litigation, before you even get into the courthouse doors. You got to fight all that stuff. It's months and months and months of litigation. But ultimately, you want to come in there and you want to file whatever motion you can file to get an evidentiary hearing. You want that evidentiary hearing and you want all that discovery. So we get all the discovery, which we actually didn't have much of a problem getting from the U.S. attorney, the assistant U.S. attorney, Cy Castle, in this particular case. And we file a motion to suppress and boom, we're in a hearing. So we get in this hearing in the motion to suppress and I put Chamberlain Neff on the stand. My motion, I put him on. Maybe shifting burden, I forget whether the U.S. attorney took him first or I took him second. So I start asking him these questions, you know. What action did you take when you saw the vehicle pass you? I read a license plate. It was a Missouri license plate. I read it on the computer. The registration did not return on file. So there's no registration on file. Well, what was it that the driver had done that was a traffic violation? A traffic violation, I didn't. Then why did you elect to pull the car over? Because the registration wasn't on file. Okay, let's go over that. The computer program is called FatPot. Has anybody ever heard of FatPot? Is this, oh, you want to, really?
Yeah, I'm not a lawyer, I'm a bondsman, but I know what it is.
Who knows what it is anyhow, you know? FatPot, he calls dispatch, and he says, here's a Missouri license plate, and dispatch says, no registration on file. I have no idea what that means. We have no idea whether it's current. We have no idea where they get their information from. We have no idea whether or not they even really are telling something that really exists in terms of the state of Missouri. But that's what he does. He runs his little fat pot, huh? Interesting. Okay, anyhow. And he says, then I believe it checks, I believe it checks with whatever database that they link off of, but I'm not exactly too sure. He doesn't even know what FatPot does. So I keep asking him about all that, and I say, when you made that inquiry, you put the 6-digit license plate number in the state you got a return on that license, correct? I did not, he doesn't answer, but he did, okay. I did not get a return. So I go even a little bit deeper. And your testimony is that using the FatPot program that links to your computer and your vehicle, that is your experience that you've been able to run license plates in other states? And he really nails me down, specifically Missouri as well. Oh, well, you got me there. How many Missouri licenses do you stop? So based on the information on that, did that in any way constitute a violation of any traffic law? Sure, it did. What was the violation? Registration violation. A vehicle not being registered and properly registered is a violation. So is your belief that at the time that the vehicle was not properly registered? Correct, it wasn't properly registered, according to my dispatch and myself. Okay, well, let's get to yourself. Now, when you saw Mr. Wiley, you approached his vehicle, you saw in the video, you had a chance to look at the license plate, correct?
I did.
Okay, let me refer you to Government's Exhibit 10. Remember the back of the vehicle? The court has a copy of this, doesn't it, Your Honor? Your Honor? Yes, he does. Okay, so, and you look at it, it's a picture of a Toyota Tundra, right? It's got the license number, it does. And is that the number that you gave to your computer? It is. Great, and in the center between the first 3 digits and the second 3 digits is a yellow tag, correct? Yes, okay, I got him that far. And when you viewed that, could you tell that that was in fact a registration for that vehicle? No, because I was never given a registration for the vehicle. See, he sidesteps me, right? When you looked at the back of the vehicle, did you determine that that was in fact a registration tag on the vehicle? So Cy Castle thinks I'm getting hot on something, so what he says? Well, Your Honor, I'm going to object. That assumes facts not in evidence that somehow the registration is a representative that the vehicle had been properly registered. There's no fact that has been offered to suggest that. That's not bad. I like that. No, there's not, and I don't know where he's going with this. Shit, man, I'm going to the essence of the case. And the court starts saying that, you know you're hot. Okay. Maybe yes, maybe no. I'm just trying to find out if he observed it. That was a registration. Don't let go. Okay, you may ask that question, you may answer. Thank you, Your Honor. Did you observe that that's a registration tag for the vehicle? No! You never looked at it? No! Remember this guy's qualifications and all the training programs he's gone through? You never looked at the stinking registration? We ever looked at what year was on the registration? I never did, no. In Utah, are vehicles registered each year by putting a little tag on the license plate? I thought maybe they had something unique in Utah. Yep, that's it, that's how they do it. So you could have made an inquiry by looking at the tag to determine A, whether it was registered for the vehicle, correct? Well, you could have. I could have. Whoa, I finally got it. And you could have made an inquiry as to what year. Oh, Cy Castle's getting nervous. Your Honor, I'm going to object. He's already answered the question. He didn't do it, so it's all just speculative. Sustain, move on. Okay. I got enough, though. Okay. So I go, well, let's stay with the registration. Blah, blah, blah. I asked him about Exhibit 7, which is the vehicle registration for Missouri. Yeah, that's it. That shows the vehicle was owned by blah. Let's go back. This is a Missouri official document. Is it not from the state of Missouri? Blah, blah. all the stuff you need to set the foundation. It appears to be, yes. Does it appear to be the title for the vehicle? It appears to be a title. And is there a date in the upper right corner? Yes. And it's a week before the stop, September 8th, 2008. Yes, sir. Approximately 1 week prior to the stop. Yes, all right. Does it show Mr. Wiley as the owner of the vehicle? It does. And it shows that he paid the fees for the ownership. It does. And then does that lead you to believe that, in fact, Mr. Wiley was a true owner of the vehicle? It does. Well, we got him. All right. So at the time, you knew he was the owner. Well, yes. Was that consistent with an inch? This is, gets fascinating because I'm listening into something. That consistent with a statement to you that he just bought the vehicle? Yes. But in your questioning regarding how much he paid for the vehicle, you made a comment. You were surprised that he paid the, quote, small amount for that vehicle, correct? But you made a comment to him on video. You said, that's really not very much for a new vehicle. You remember saying that? I do. So frankly, you seem to be under the impression that he was buying a new vehicle and he bought a new vehicle. That was your comment, correct? I'm sorry to restate that. I lost my train of thought. It wasn't hard for him. My question is, you said, wow, that's not much for a new truck. Those are your words you said when you talked to him, correct? Okay, so in your mind, that was a brand new truck. Yeah, it was a nice truck. It appeared nice, new to me. Didn't answer my question. That's fair enough. If you took the title reading report, said here's the vehicle, odometer reading, correct, correct, and the rest of the year, 2002. Do you have any reason to doubt that? No. So 6 years old at the time of the stop, correct? So I'm just impeaching this guy's training experience and all of his skills, and he can't even look at a registration certificate, and he can't even look at a license plate for crying out loud. You know, it's embarrassing at this point. Six-year-old vehicle, it's got 67,000 miles on it, yeah. So it's not a new vehicle. Well, he goes, he's getting weary of me. I guess in my opinion, at the side of the road without really looking at that in detail, as I do now today, before you search the car, it appeared to be a nice new vehicle, but yes, I agree with you. Yes, it has 60,000 miles. Yes, it's a six-year-old vehicle. Gee, thanks, Chamberlain. So we could probably say that with you having the vehicle title in your hand, and you're talking to Mr. Wiley about your purchase of the vehicle, and his consistent answers to you about how he purchased it, why it was not suspicious at all, is it? Oh, about why is not suspicious at all, is it? And get this twist he tries to pull. No, I thought he got a real deal on it, but I mean, for me, you know, my experience in having, again, drug organizations purchase vehicles and have them registered to people that are actually driving the vehicle, it was on my mind. See, he's trying to snare my guy into being it. Oh, you got to call him on that. So right away, you're thinking that Mr. Wiley's part of a drug organization that's purchased a vehicle for him to register in his name to drive for drug purposes? Science doesn't like that at all. I object, argumentative, Mr. Michael. He just stated it, Your Honor. Overruled, you can answer. Oh, I'm getting hot. Okay. I would say no. You're not thinking that about Mr. Wiley. Not immediately, no. Okay, all right. And the mileage, and it's consistent, and the mileage consistent. You never cited him for a traffic violation when you told him to have a nice day. Of course, he searched the vehicle right after he said that. No, I didn't have a violation. I believe the vehicle belonged to him, and he had the proper registered paperwork. I'm not going to write a ticket for nothing. That's it. That's it. You know, you got to kill him that way. That was fun, though.
So,
there's the vehicle. His picture. Oh, I didn't take that picture. He took it. How can you take a picture of it and not go look at the damn license plate and registration? Now, there was a whole bunch of other issues that he raised about, you know, why my client, why he had reasonable suspicion. And I won't get into his testimony, but I'm going to get into Judge Sam's opinion, ultimately, in the district court. And he goes over some of the things that he thought created reasonable suspicion. And you really got to watch out for this issue of reasonable suspicion. It's just, they just throw anything up before these judges, and these judges bite on them for reasonable suspicion. And it's one of the biggest battles you got to have. Don't let them get in the car. Don't let them develop reasonable suspicion. They can do a traffic stop. They can do something that they consider legitimate. You're never going to get a win on a traffic stop. I tried to win a traffic stop once, and I had a road expert testify about the speed of the vehicle, and we did the video thing and everything. It's really difficult. The judges will always let them do the traffic stop. But you've got to stop them from developing that reasonable suspicion to go further and detain the person further and search the vehicle. And that issue was actually addressed in the new Rodriguez case that Brenda mentioned, and that Jerry Goldstein is also going to mention tomorrow. A great Supreme Court case about reasonable suspicion and traffic stop and the time it takes to write a citation. You got to trap them there. So, but one of the issues that this trooper Neff raised, and they all raised this issue, and you saw it in the whole thing on desert snow courses that they take, is this thing about source city and distribution city. So we have a footnote that we put in all of our briefs, and this is just a partial footnote, but you can see in these footnotes, everything's a destination city. Everything's a source city. Go find all the cases. Look at this, the entire West Coast? Okay. You cannot travel across the country without violating the law. Okay, Long Beach, I don't know why they got Long Beach, Phoenix, Oakland, hey, right near my town, Ontario, and all these other cities. You know, so if you ever get an issue about a source city or a destination city, just go research all the cases where all the law enforcement officers have testified about what's a source city, a destination city. It's every city over 10,000 population in the United States, and maybe some cities less than 10,000. Matter of fact, I think there's a case where the officer testified that any city over 10,000 population is a destination or source city. So anyhow, I just thought I'd throw that one in. So we finished the suppression hearing, Cy Castle comes up to me and he goes, "John, that was a great suppression hearing." He goes, "We're going to lose. You're going to win." I says, "Yeah, I can't see how I can't win. I thought it was a great suppression hearing. I really had a good feeling after the hearing, you know." And Judge Sam was being his normal nice guy. So boom, we finished the suppression hearing. Got to wait for Judge Sam's opinion, and here it comes: memorandum, decision, and order. And Judge Sam dumps on me. Okay, the nice guy that sits around talking to me after court, he dumps on me. So that's okay. I can handle that. So here's his opinion, and he tries to say, here's his reasons. What are his reasons? He keeps going into this whole thing about the Missouri license plate, and Judge Sam doesn't even recognize all this testimony I got about it. He says there was a possible violation because the license plate did not return as being registered. Come on, Judge. You know, get with the real stuff. And he has a little footnote here about how a person may not operate a vehicle in Utah without it being registered, but vehicles registered in other states are exempt. But here, so there was no registration. No, Trooper Neff could not find a valid registration. Trooper Neff could not find anything. Anything in this case. On file for the vehicle, arguably, therefore, the exemption did not apply. So he dumps on me on that whole beautiful argument we have, which I was really upset about. And here's some other red flag indicators of Trooper Neff would support a conclusion that his suspicions were objectively reasonable. And then the judge says, all these considered together under this horrible totality of the circumstances phrase that we all hate, because you always can find some guilt in that. Implausible travel plans. What are my client's implausible travel plans? That was the one about going to a source city or coming from a source city. So we got him on, he's driving to the West Coast. Okay. Then, this is really fascinating. I forgot this one. I just noticed this on this argument. The trooper Neff gets my guy in the car, as they always do, and he goes, where are you going? He's going, I'm going to see my aunt. She's old, and I'm going to help do some work on her house, and then I'm going to go see my friend. He goes, well, who are they? Do you have their phone numbers? Yes. He gives them the phone numbers. He has dispatch dial the phone numbers of the aunt and the friend. Nobody answers the phones, okay? How is that suspicious? You gotta wonder. But Judge Sam knows why they're suspicious, and so does Trooper Neff. It says, this'll blow me away, it says, people traveling across country that are involved in criminal activity often state that they're, this is Trooper Neff telling Judge Sam in his testimony, that they're going to aid an elderly or sick relative in order to ingratiate themselves with law enforcement and to appear to be cooperative and friendly. What? What? We're doomed. You can't say anything. I'm going home to my wife and kids. Oh, that's suspicious. No, they always say that. Okay. And they couldn't find that. So So he dooms me on that. What else does he do? I don't even remember. Implausible travel plans, because he was going across Utah, which is a beautiful state, and Trooper Neff says, why are you driving across our ugly state? Okay. Appearance and contents of the vehicle. Trooper Neff said that based on his training and experience, the motoring public traveling across country in pursuit of innocent activities will periodically stop and tidy up their vehicle.
Yeah.
I'm doomed. I'm doomed in Utah. I'm not making this shit up. And this Judge Sam's an intelligent guy. Where do you see what happens later? Okay, training and experience, driver organization provide newly purchased vehicles for low prices, register those vehicles in the name of the driver. What happened to my testimony? What? And he bought into this drug organization thing. Give me a break. You know, Trooper Neff keeps talking about his training and experience. So I'm questioning him, because every time the AUSA Castle asks him a question, he goes, in my training and experience, blah, blah, blah. In my training and experience. So I get up there and I go, God, Trooper Neff, how long have you been a law enforcement officer? Oh, about 2 years, 2.5 years. I go, okay. And what did you do before that? I sold washing machines. That's his answer. It's in the transcript. I sold washing machines. And this guy's got all this training experience because that's what they teach him to say. They teach him to say it in my training and experience. He has had no stinking training experience. He's got a lot of training, but who knows about his experience. Anyhow, Judge Sam buys into it. And totality of the circumstances, I'm doomed. Unemployment triggered suspicion, sure. Blah, 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 blah. Based on Trooper Neff's testimony and other evidence presented, the court finds that Trooper Neff had an objectively reasonable suspicion that Mr. Wiley was involved in criminal activity involving drug trafficking. What? Where's the drug trafficking? Nothing. There's no drugs. Where does he get the drug? Suspicious. Maybe he's doing something else illegal that has nothing to do with drugs. That suspicion warranted Mr. Wiley's further detention beyond the investigation of the traffic stop. That's the killer. That kills us. There goes reasonable suspicion. There goes the search. They got the money. And I'm going to lose my motion to suppress. Yep. For the reasons stated, Mr. Wiley's motion to suppress evidence, document 291, is denied. Oh, we're doomed. Okay. So what? At the time I'm doing this case, I have got three other district court cases where I've been kicked out of court. I'm not afraid of being kicked out of district court, and I'll take this case up to the Court of Appeals. So, what do we do? Let me see what's next here. I don't even know. Ah, the Court of Appeals. So, what we do is we do a deal with the U.S. Attorney and with the court. I don't want to go into a merits hearing on this particular case. I don't want to have to get to the point where I've got to show innocent ownership, because there are some bumps in the road when you get to that point when your client's carrying a whole bunch of money. So I do a deal, and we agree to the forfeiture, and we preserve the right to raise the appeal on the denial of the motion to suppress. So that's where we are in the Court of Appeals. We are just litigating only the motion to suppress. If I lose the appeal on the motion to suppress, the case is over and the property is forfeited, because I've already stipulated to that. So that's all we got left. So we go up to the Court of Appeals. We do all the briefings. We do all the exhibits. We get this really interesting decision by the 10th Circuit, Briscoe, Abel, and Phillips. And here's how they analyze it in a very interesting way. They go, all panel members agree that the initial stop was justified at its inception. Well, we didn't dispute that. Judge Phillips and Judge Ebel both vote to reverse the district court's order denying suppression. Judge Phillips says, reasonable suspicion of any registration offense, blah, 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 dissipated when the trooper learned or should have learned that the state of Missouri had issued the plate and its registration tab within 2 weeks of the traffic stop. Now that's interesting, because Judge Phillips, he is reasoning the same way the Supreme Court just reasoned a month ago in this Rodriguez case. Okay, so he's smart. Although he even agreed that if he didn't win that way, Although Judge Phillips agreed with Chief Judge Briscoe, ooh, evil Judge Briscoe, that the trooper had reasonable suspicion of illegal drug activity by the end of the stop, Judge Phillips reasons that the government cannot rely on the key facts suggesting illicit drug activity because the trooper learned those facts after Wiley was entitled to be released, period. Judge Evil reasons that reasonable suspicion continued up to the point that the trooper returned his driving documents. So he's got a little later dissipation of reasonable suspicion. And the trooper lacked reasonable suspicion of legal drug activity before continuing to detain Wiley in order to deploy the drug dog. Chief Judge Briscoe dissented, so forget her, reasoning that the trooper had reasonable suspicion of a registration-related offense up until he returned Wiley's driving document. And by then, he had a separate reasonable suspicion of illegal drug activity. Anyhow, we reversed the district court's order, denying suppression, and we remand for further proceedings. Winner.
Yep.
I don't care if it's 2-1. No, that's just the beginning of the story. That's the introduction. That is the introduction. Okay, now, there's two issues we're talking about. We're talking about highway interdiction, and we're talking about attorney fees. Attorney fees. So what happens after that decision comes down? Fascinating. Judge, my co-counsel, Rick Van Wagener, calls me up and he goes, listen, Judge Sams wants to have a conference with all the attorneys. I said, well, heck, the mandate hasn't even issued. He says, Judge Sam doesn't care. He wants to have a conference. Well, okay, well, he doesn't have jurisdiction yet, but let's have a conference. So I say, can I do it by telephone? And he says, I'll check with the judge. Judge Sam says, fine, David, you can call in. Here's the time to call in. So I call in at the status conference, and Judge Sam goes, David, what a great victory. You did a great job. I'm really proud of you. Okay, I like him. I really like this guy. So, but you know, the theory is that Judge Sam, if you're going up against the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints or the U.S. government, you don't have much of a chance, okay? But he wants to redeem himself now, okay? That's what I'm thinking. Because we had some nice conversations before. So he goes, listen, he says, U.S. Attorney's got four people here. They must have thought you were appearing in person. I go, okay. So he goes, I said, Judge, the mandate hasn't issued yet. So he goes, that's okay, we're just doing an informal conversation. He goes, where are we going from here? I says, well, you know, even though you win a suppression motion, the government can still proceed with the case, same in criminal law. All you're doing is suppressing some property, but if they've got other evidence that they can use to support their case, they're going to go forward with the other evidence. So I say, well, how much time do I have?
A week.
No, right now.
It's 11:45 right now.
Already? Okay, so Judge, I got to wait for the U.S. attorney to decide whether or not they're going to dismiss the case or go forward. And so the Judge Sam says, okay, that's fine. And then he says, David, he says, you got to come and see the new federal building, the new federal courthouse in Salt Lake City. He says, I'm the chief judge. He says, I've got the biggest chambers in the federal building. I'm up on the 10th floor. He says, get on over here and come and see my building. Okay, so
there it is. That is the new federal building in Salt Lake City. Okay, the federal courthouse, you saw the old building, and guess what? There is Judge Sam's chambers. I'm telling you, that's his chambers. And check out that window, because I'll tell you a story about that. So I go, look at this beautiful building. It's all glass. It's glass. And when you walk up to the court chambers, you know, you're used to walking in court chambers, you see walls and doors, right? This is all glass. You can look into every single judge's chambers, you can see a staff, and then the judge's private chambers are in back in a closed door. You walk around the building, it's like walking in Nordstrom or something. You know, you see all the different judges' chambers. Beautiful, beautiful setup. So I call Rick and I say, Rick, I says, I gotta come over and see Judge Sam, you know, because he doesn't know what's coming down. Nobody knows what's coming down. I'm waiting for the government to dismiss the case. I'm not saying diddly squat about attorney fees, not a word. So Rick and I go over there, and we go over to the federal court. I arrange a time to go see him. He said, come up about 11 o'clock this one day. So I fly over there. We go to see Judge Sam, and Judge Sam and I spend 3 hours talking, 3 hours in his chambers, and we talk about everything. He was a pilot, and I fly little planes, but he was a pilot in the military. He knows all about airplanes, and he told me a B-17 story that blew me away. I had a B-17 story I could tell him about another judge in New Jersey
But it would take me a long time to tell you that story, but it was a great B-17 story. I told him my B-17 story, he told me his. And then we talked about beekeeping. He's a beekeeper from way back. Matter of fact, he tried to get the architect and contractor, you see his chamber? He wanted them to cut a round hole in his chamber's window. He was going to put a beehive in his chambers and let the bees fly out of that round hole and come back, and he would have his hive in his chambers. This guy was a work of art. I loved it. So anyhow, they wouldn't let him do that. So we talked about bee culture because I had a good friend who raised a lot of bees, and I know about bee culture and everything. So he has this book. His friend was a pilot. I'll show you this. His friend was a pilot in this B-17 in the Second World War. And you see this B-17 is all ravaged, and there's Messerschmitt, a German Messerschmitt flying alongside this B-17. And this German pilot saves this crew on this B-17. He commits a treasonable offense in Germany and shows them how to get to a place where they can land safely because he can't make it across the channel to England because look at the planes all shot up. And he's telling me this fascinating story and how all these people got together afterwards. And he grabs this book that's written about it called The Higher Call. And he goes, David, I want you to have this book because we told these two B-17 stories. And he writes something in the corner of the inlay of the book for me. And he goes, can you read it? To David, best wishes to a great trial attorney, Judge David Sam. Okay? So after this three-hour meeting, we walk out, and Rick looks at me and he goes, you idiot, you idiot. You know what you just did? He says, you just had this big ex-party schmoozing communication with this judge. You file your attorney fee motion. He's going to think that you snookered him. You came in and you talked nice to him just to get him to like you. And then you're going to file this attorney fee motion and he's going to feel betrayed, totally betrayed. So I freak out. It's Friday afternoon. I go, oh, shit. Okay, so I think about what to do. The Monday morning, I call his clerk and I say, Kathy, I said, you know, I just came last Friday to talk to Judge Sam for a few minutes just to say hi on my way to Nebraska. And I said, we ended up having a three-hour discussion. She goes, oh, yeah, everybody knows about that three-hour meeting between you and Judge Sam. Told the whole court. So I go, shit. I said, listen, I'm worried that the government may construe that as an ex-party communication. I said, and I really don't want them to raise that issue. What can I do? What can I do? She goes, well, there's a judge we have that handles conflict stuff. And she goes, I'll tell that judge. She goes, and I'll tell Judge Sam you called. So I, okay, thank you very much. Boom. I'm covering my ass on any contingency. Judge Sam, 5 minutes later, calls me back. David, why? What's this thing that you're worried about? I said, Judge, yeah, so I had a great time with you. I only thought I was going to talk to you for a couple of minutes. I said, but I'm worried now that the government may think that I had an ex-party communication with you. He goes, well, did we talk about the case? I said, no, we didn't say a word about the case, not one word. He goes, well, he says, what are you going to file? I said, I got a motion for attorney fees that I still have to file if they decide not to pursue the litigation, which they won't because they got no other evidence. He goes, well, do they know about the motion? I said, well, it's in the statutes. They must know about it. They're forfeiture attorneys. You know? So he goes, ah, forget about it. Hangs up the phone, okay? So that's done. So what do we do? What do we do? What do we do?
Beast.
Now, I'll tell you about this book later, okay? That's my beekeeping book that I'm going to bring him as a present later on. So we do this motion from hell on attorney fees. And you get attorney fees not only for litigating the case below, but you get attorney fees for litigating the appeal. You come back down to the district court, and you file the attorney fees motion from hell. Luckily, I've got an associate who knows how to keep tabs of things, because I don't know how to keep tabs of things. So we do this nasty motion from hell, attorney fees. We ask for $194,000, okay? And we say we are specialized attorneys. We have specialized knowledge and experience of forfeiture cases. You smoke everything you can, you know, about your specialty, because it's important to say that you have a specialized training, because you got to watch out about them giving you some normal attorney rate. Specialized training experience is something that gets a much higher rate of pay. And if you ever want evidence that a forfeiture attorney has a specialized practice, then all you have to do is go look at the U.S. Attorney's Office. They all have a separate forfeiture division. They all advertise their forfeiture division as having specialized knowledge. Their forfeiture division only does forfeiture cases. They don't mix with any other civil division. They don't mix with the criminal division.
You know, they acknowledge that it's a specialized training, but they try to say when you get attorney fees that it's not. Okay, I smoke everything I can. I brag about every possible thing. My declaration, civil forfeiture, specialized. I'm an attorney with more than 36 years. Blah, 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 what my hourly rate is, how much I got in. I did a $2 million case, down, or $1 million case down here, and I got $300,000 at $600 an hour in Southern California. I used that. I used everything. We substantially prevailed, no big deal. We used this thing called the Lodestar, reasonable rates. And then I asked for so much an hour for me. But I asked for, like, 1 year I asked for one rate, and another year another rate, and another year another rate. It was 3 years. And actually, I should have asked for more, as that shows up later on. So in the end, we asked for, and Ed Birch asked for something, and so does Rick Van Wagener, which is our local council, didn't do much. So we're asking for a whole bunch of money, okay? And of course, the government, of my declaration, and you got to do all your timesheets. Look at that. I mean, my associate did all this stuff, but you know, you got to do 0.2 or 0.3 hours, and I never keep timesheets, but he knows how to keep it really well. But you got to do every single detail, list every single thing you did every year, you know? I don't even remember what I did last month. Okay, and then Ed, my loyal associate, he does this thing called the Leahy Matrix, which shows that attorneys with more years of experience get more money and that kind of stuff, which is a factor that you use. And then he does his own attorney fee thing and all the hours he spent. And we go on and on and on. And ultimately in this, and then we do the final thing in the expenses. And then here's their opposition. Who are these guys? We don't deserve anything. We didn't do anything more than what a normal lawyer in Utah could have done without any experience whatsoever. First year law student could have won this case. Personal. Forget it. These guys don't deserve anything. We only should get $65,000 instead of $194,000.
Okay,
So, we do a reply. I get a declaration from David Smith, who is the author of the two-volume treatise on forfeitures, cited by the courts all the time. He is the guru, the expert on civil forfeitures. His treatise is what really is a spearhead for all research on forfeiture law. I get a declaration from Eric Honig, who writes a newsletter called the Forfeiture, what's it called? Federal Forfeiture Guide? I think it's Federal Forfeiture Guide. It's a newsletter. He puts out a green sheet every 2 weeks, talks about all the cases that have been decided. These guys are like top-notch federal forfeiture lawyers. I respect them. They're my peers. They say I'm a great guy. I'm a brilliant forfeiture lawyer and all that stuff. Anything you have to say, that you can say in there. And we fight it, and there's David Smith, and he does his declaration. So, but then we find out in the reply that the government had cited this case called Fischel. And Fischel was interesting. I actually went and read it. And Fischel said that I undercharged them. And they cited this case, because Fischel says, if you have year one, and you got that rate, and year two at a higher rate, and then year three at an even higher rate, you get to get the highest rate for all 3 years because you get deferred payment. Now that makes sense, and I didn't even think about that. So we ended up saying, heck, we understated our fee demand. It's now $224,000. That's how we got. Judge Sam, does he love me or doesn't he? I don't know. Memorandum of order. Court concludes, specialized practice requires special skills. Yes, no Utah attorney with the requisite special skills were available. Finds the relevant community is my community, the highest community in the universe, the West Coast.
Very high.
Okay, yeah, very high. So he gives us that. He excludes the $1,200. I don't care. Resolving, no reduction warranted there. Okay, he deducts $1,400. Well, that's nothing. Reduces $1,700. That's okay. Reduces $1,800. He's throwing some bones to the government. I know what he's doing. Reduces another $1,700. And my conclusion is $195,797.50. That was fun. I enjoyed that case a whole lot. And I really enjoyed Judge Sam. I am going to bring Judge Sam. This case is over, it's dead, so there's no conflict. I have a 1917 volume of the ABC and XYZ of bee culture. He has a modern version of it. He is so into beekeeping, you know, way beyond anything I would ever know. I happen to have that 1917 first edition. I am going to Utah because the money just got into my trust account. I'm going wait for the right thing. I'm going to Utah and I'm going to give him a present of that 1917 volume, ABC and XYZ of Bee Culture. And I'll love Jed Sam forever. Now, don't be afraid of these district courts. I'm telling you, I got kicked out of district court in Iowa. I went up to the 8th Circuit. I won that, got sent back to Iowa, won that case. I got kicked out of the district court in Chicago on two separate cases. This all happened in the same year. I get kicked out by Judge Shader on a $1 million forfeiture case, and I knew I was doomed in Shader's court because I walked in there and I went, Mr. Michael, you're that attorney from California. Strike one. Mr. Michael, I'm trying to help your client. Oh, strike two. Mr. Michael, do you know what you're doing? So Shader kicks me out of court on the government's motion to strike the claim. We don't even get to summary judgment. They just strike my client's claim because I refused to cooperate with him.